I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Last night we gave a reading of mostly 19th century poetry, and I realised that I think in Russia there is a pretty clear idea of who the great 19th century poets are. Many of them haven't been translated well into English before, and so we have a very poor idea of who the great Russian 19th century poets are. In the 20th century, it's kind of even worse than that. I think there's been so much confusion introduced by politics and all kinds of extra literary things that I think it'll be a long time before anyone really has a clear consensus has arrived about who are the great 20th century Russian poets. What I did gradually come to feel more and more strongly towards the end of work on this is that there is an extraordinary amount of great 20th century poetry. One can't really sensibly say this kind of thing for another few centuries, but I can easily imagine that in the future 20th century Russian poetry might be seen as one of the great flowerings of poetry in a European language, like Dante's Italy or like medieval Persia. But anyway, tonight's readings are all 20th century. We're going to start with two poets who always have been well known, but who've also often sort of been admired for the wrong reasons or disliked for the wrong reasons. So one of them is Yesenin, who has always had a considerable popularity in Russia, a kind of romantic figure of a peasant poet, and he committed suicide, and he was married to Isadora Duncan. More sort of intellectual lovers of poetry have quite often tended to look down on him, and it was actually a surprise to me, and I was partly kind of helped into this by Boris to realise, you know, just what a great poet he is and what a kind of natural gift for singing lyrics he has. And I think we've reproduced that in a few translations. So Boris is going to read two.
These two poems were written in the last year of his life, actually in the last 2 months of his life, before he committed suicide in 1925. It was a very productive year for Yesenin. The first poem, I'll have to say one introductory word about it, and it's in the notes to the volume. It mentions two cards. Cards are very important for Russians. They enjoy divination, and they enjoy card playing. And Yesenin had a reputation as a card player. He also had a reputation as a bit of a criminal. So there is a symbolism to these two cards. The first card that's mentioned is the Ace of Spades, which is immediately evocative of Pushkin's great short story, the Queen of Spades, rather. And the second card is the Ace of Diamonds, which is immediately evocative of the criminal lifestyle. The diamond shape was woven onto the backs of criminals' uniforms. So it's associated with criminality. Poor poet, was that really you, addressing the moon in rhyme? My eyes were dulled so long ago by love, by cards and wine. The moon climbs through the window frame, white light, so white it blinds you. I bet on the Queen of Spades, but I played the Ace of Diamonds. The second poem was written shortly after that, and really demonstrates his musical gift. Oh, to hell with this storm. Damn this snow and hail, pounding on the rooftop, driving in white nails. But me, I'm not frightened, and I know my fate. My wastrel heart has nailed me to you, nailed us tight.
There were a number of deaths of poets in the 1920s that had a tremendous resonance in Russia. And the first was Anna Akhmatova's husband, the poet Nikolai Gumilev, who was shot by the Bolsheviks in 1921. That happened to coincide very closely with the death, very young, though, by illness of Alexander Blok. And that seemed like a sort of whole world had died then in 1921. And then Yesenin's suicide in 1925 also was an enormous shock to many, many people. And this is Yesenin's suicide poem. Farewell, dear friend, farewell. You're present in my heart. We'll meet again, the stars foretell, though now we have to part. Goodbye for now, goodbye, dear friend. No handshake, words, or grief. To die is nothing new, but then what new is left in life? And we're going to go on to the other poet who has always been known for a long time, Mayakovsky, but who also is, we tend to have a very kind of oversimplified picture of. We don't realise how extraordinarily gifted he was formerly. James Womack's translations are the first ones that, well, actually James and Stephen's translations are the first ones that really kind of use rhyme wittily and intelligently, like Mayakovsky himself. And also Peter Orams, who've actually got three good translators in this volume. He's often seen as a kind of revolutionary loudmouth, which he was, but he's much, much more varied than that, a poet capable of great delicacy and tenderness and intelligence. So, James.
This is the end of a long poem, A Cloud in Trousers. What you need to know so far is that he's spent most of the poem attacking all the received ideas about art and life in general. And he spent the third section trying to persuade this woman, Maria, to open up her front door to him. And she hasn't, and so he decides that he's going to go off somewhere else. Maria, you don't want to? You don't want to? Ha! Well, dark and downcast, I'll take up my heart once again and carry it off, crying, like a dog carries his paw back to the kennel after it's been run over by a train. My heart's blood will make the road happy. The red flowers show bright among the dust on my coat. Like the sun round the earth, a thousand times Salome will dance round the head of the Baptist. And when my tally of years finally plays itself out, a million drops of blood will cover the road to my father's house. I'll climb up to heaven. I'll be dirty. I slept in the gutter. I'll stand next to him, bend down, and speak into his ear. Listen up, Mr. God. Don't you get bored up here in the sky, spending all day looking down? Here's a plan. Let's chop down that tree, the one in your garden, and make it into a merry-go-round. If you're omnipresent, you can get into all the cellars and bring some quality wine back up. Then maybe, just maybe, Peter the Apostle can be persuaded to lighten up. And let's get some Eves back among the heavenly host. I'll show you. This evening I'll gather the most beautiful girls from the boulevards for you. You want to? You don't want to. You shake your head. Goldilocks, are you frowning? Do you think that all this winged nonsense here has a clue about what love is? I'm also an angel. I was one back down there. I looked out through these eyes like a little lamb. But I'm wasting my sweetness on the desert air. It's like setting up a china shop and whistling for a bull. You're omnipotent. And you thought up hands, and you gave everybody a head, or something. How come you couldn't work out a plan so we could kiss, kiss, kiss without suffering? I thought you were all powerful, the real God Almighty, but you're just a dimwit, crusty little godkin. See, I bend down and from the top of my boot pull out my shiv, my bare bodkin. You scoundrel, you with your wings. It's only in heaven you have any presence. You must be scared, your feathers are bristling. I'll slice you from here to Alaska, you and your incense. Goodbye. They can't stop me. I may be right or wrong, but I can't settle down. Look, they've got blood all over the sky. And they've beheaded the stars again. Hey you, sky, take off your hat. Can't you see I'm coming? Needs to wash out its ears. The universe is asleep, and one huge ear, covered in stars like fleas, flops over its paws.
So we're now coming to a generation of poets we have heard much less about. Two poets who knew each other well, Maria Petrova and Arseniy Tarkovsky, they're part of a generation of gifted lyrical poets who understood around the late 20s, early 30s, that there was just sort of no possibility of they just weren't going to be Soviet poets. They earned their living as verse translators. There was a vast industry throughout the Soviet period of people preparing literals from all the different languages of the Soviet Union, also from other European languages, and giving these to poets like Tarkovsky, Liebkin, Petrova, Akhmatova did a huge amount of translating, so did Pasternak. And most of them did. But some of them, like Akhmatova and Pasternak, were known as poets. Others, Petrova was known as a translator. Only a few people, really, it was only the little circle, Akhmatova, Mandelstam, people close to her who really knew her poetry. And it wasn't her first book was published really quite late in life, and tellingly it was published in Armenia, where she was valued because she translated a great deal from Armenia. There's a very fierce directness in some of these poems. Quite a lot of love poems. Love me. I am pitch black, sinful, blind, confused. But if not you, who else is going to love me? Face to face and fate to fate. See how stars shine bright in the dark sky. Love me simply, simply, as day loves night and night loves day. You have no choice. I am pure night and you pure light. That was 1942. The next poem can be read as a poem about the Khrushchev thaw and the kind of apparent liberalisation in the mid-50s. March saw winter gain in strength. Bitter cold and unrelenting storms. In reckless fury, blinding spite, the wind blew only from the north. No hint of spring. Gripped by inertia, the heart slips all too close to places of no return. No self, no words, mere apathy and voicelessness. Who can bring back our sight, our hearing? Who can retrace the way to hearth and home? Now that all trace of home is gone, wiped from the earth. It was hearing that last stanza in a talk given by a Russian that I was finding quite difficult to understand, but that last stanza I understood immediately. It's tremendously powerful. So, in Russian now. So, Irina Mashinsky.
I will read the same poem in Russian, and it might be interesting to note that the time the poem was written, it was March 1955, which means 2 years, exactly 2 years after Stalin's death, and 1 year before the party congress with all the revelations for those who didn't know. So, and the word thaw, as Robert pointed out, is really important here. Зима установилась в марте. С морозами, с кипением вьюг, в злорадном, яростном азарте бьет ветер с севера на юг. Ни признака весны, и сердце достигнет роковой черты во власти гибельных инерций, бесчувствия и немоты. Кто речь вернет глухонемому? Слепому кто покажет свет? И как найти дорогу к дому, которого на свете нет?
I'll read another love poem from the 1970s, very late. Words lying empty, without breathing, that don't know why they exist at all. Words with no goal, words with no meaning, that shelter no one from the cold, and haven't fed a single soul. Words of impotence, of the weak, words that don't dare, too shy to speak. They give no heat, they shed no light, but with an orphan's grief go mute, not knowing they are mutilated.
And the other poet I've just mentioned, Arseny Tarkovsky. Many of you will know a little of his poetry from the films made by his son, Andrei. He is increasingly being well translated into English. In a moment, Irina will read the poem that she and Boris translated together, which won was first prize.
Yes.
Which won first prize at the Brodsky Spender Prize a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And actually, the results of this year's Brodsky Spender Prize have just very recently been published, and there are two Tarkovsky translations, one among the prize winners and one among the honourable recommendations by Peter Oram, whose translations we've got quite a lot of in this book. So he is someone who kind of, a lot of people are realising what a fine poet he is in his own right and succeeding in translating him.
Incidentally, Tarkovsky was a friend of Petrovich, and he also was a translator. He translated during those years when one could not publish one's own poems and could only translate. And his first collection only appeared when he was about around 60. Field Hospital, the Russian version is amazingly beautiful. Unfortunately, we do not have time for both versions, so I'm only reading the English one. It is important to know that Tarkovsky fought in the war, that he returned, he underwent multiple operations, left a leg. So when you hear the line, trees on broken legs, it may be important to remember that. And of course, it's a field hospital. They turned the table to the light. I lay upside down, like meat slapped onto a scale. My soul swayed, dangling on a string. I saw myself from this side, balanced without make weights, against a fat mass from the market. This was in the middle of a snow shield, chipped along its western edge, surrounded by icy swamps, by trees on broken legs. And railroads halts with their skulls cracked open, looking black beneath their snowy caps. Some double, and some triple. Time stopped that day. Clocks didn't run. The souls of trains no longer flew along the mounds, lightless on grizzled fins of steam. No gatherings of crows. No blizzards. No thaws inside that limbo where I lay naked in disgrace in my own blood outside the pool of future's gravity. But then it shifted, circling on its axis, the shield of blinding snow, a wedge of seven airplanes turned low above me, and the gauze, like tree bark, stiffened on my body, where someone else's blood now ran into my veins out of a flask, and I breathed like a fish tossed on the sand, gulping the hard, earthy, mica-like, cold and blessed air. My lips were chapped, and then they fed me with a spoon, and then I couldn't recall my name. Well, King David's lexicon awoke upon my tongue. Then snow melted away, and early spring stood on her toes and wrapped the trees with her green kerchief.
So one of the great discoveries for me was the poetry of Georgi Ivanov. He was an emigre. He was the kind of one of the youngest of the Akhmest group that gathered around Gumilyov and Akhmatova. Many people, I think, of my generation were brought up to detest Ivanov. He published a book of memoirs in Petersburg, but he does actually make quite clear, or not to be taken literally, that there is sort of a mixture of fiction and memoir. But people like Akhmatova and Nadezhda Mandelstam, who were having enough trouble with the kind of lies put about by the Soviet authorities, were just enraged that somebody who had the freedom to speak truthfully should be apparently kind of lying about it. And so many of us were kind of brought up to just think of him as a sort of, you know, contemptible, dishonest rogue. I think his reputation in the West probably wasn't helped by, he died in a home for stateless people somewhere near Nice in the 1950s. It's sort of not quite the romantic end of, it's not a heroic or romantic end. I think if I were choosing a little book of 100 greatest lyric poems in Russian, less than 12 lines, I think probably kind of 9 or 10 of them could easily be by Ivanov. He's a quite wonderful poet. Endlessly startling, an extraordinary mixture of kind of formal elegance and conversational language, and very, very varied in tone. So much of his poetry is full of nostalgia for Petersburg and his Russian life and for Russian poetry. This is one of relatively few where he's engaging more with French culture. So behind this poem lies François Villon and his Where Are the Snows of Yesteryear. Where can I look, where can I go to find that almost alpine snow, all sacrificed so life can grow, all turned by May to splash and flow, to breath of dandelion and rose, to mighty wave or shining billow, into that foolish question posed by François Villon long ago. And in a very, very different tone, I think this is really a kind of almost psychotic shrug of the shoulders, or pretend shrug of the shoulders, in response to kind of all the horrors of the mid-20th century. It really did shock me, reading it in Russian. Led by what is shining, the sleepwalker looks into a blank. Black is the death beneath him, and there's no knowing where the moon's thin ledge will slide him. The innocent are executed in a universal night. Look the other way. Look into cold nothing and let its moonshine take you beyond all understanding.
I will read the same, the original. It's 1948. Лунатик в пустоту глядит, сияние им руководит, чернеет гибель снизу. И далее угадать нельзя, куда он движется, скользя по лунному карнизу. Расстреливают палачи невинных в мировой ночи. Не обращай внимания, смотри в холодное ничто, в сияние постигая то, что выше понимания.
I'll read two translations of two of my translations of poems by Ivanov. As Robert's mentioned, one of the characteristics of Ivanov's poetry is its extreme brevity. The first translation I'll read is from his first collection that he published in exile, called Rose. It was published in 1931. At 13 lines long, it counts as an epic by Ivanov standards. And it goes like this. It's good that Russia has no Tsar. It's good that Russia is just a dream. It's good that God has disappeared, that nothing's real except the stars, in icy skies the yellow gleam of dawn, the unrelenting years. It's good that people don't exist, that nothingness is all there is, that life's as dark and cold as this. Until we couldn't be more dead, nor ever were so dark before, and no one now can bring us aid, nor even needs to anymore. I think it's the brevity that is one of the things that makes Ivanov so difficult to translate. I don't know if the others would agree, but I think as a rule of thumb, the shorter the poem, the more difficult it is to translate. Longer poems are easier to translate. That's my view anyway. The second translation I'll read is from a later collection, Portrait Without a Likeness, which was published in 1950. And it's absolutely typical. I think it's absolutely quintessential, typical Ivanov. Like the earlier poem, it doesn't have a title. Some things succeed and some things fail. Everything's nonsense that passes away. But even so, this reddish-brown grass, which grows by a gate in the fence, will last. If Russian speech has the power to go back to the land where the Neva flows, from Paris I send these muddled words, though even to me they sound absurd. Before I finish, I'd like to quote a brief comment made by Professor Jerry Smith on Ivanov. Jerry Smith probably knows more than anyone in this country about Russian poetry, and he said of Ivanov, Georgi Ivanov was arguably the most important Russian poet in the world during the last 30 years of his life. Now, the last 30 years of Ivanov's life was from 1928 to 1958, and that's a period when Boris Pasternak and Anna Rakhmatova were both still writing. So, as you can see, some people have a very, very high opinion of Ivanov.
And a particular thank you to Stephen, who was very dogged. He cottoned on to Ivanov's greatness long before I did, and kept him.
You took some persuading, but you saw the light in there.
Yes, the light. The light or the darkness. This is a poem very late in his career, written in 1956. I still find charm in little accidental trifles, empty little things, say, in a novel without end or title, or in this rose, now wilting in my hands. I like its moiré petals, dappled with trembling silver drops of rain, and how I found it on the sidewalk, and how I'll toss it in a garbage can.
I'm going to throw in one more unplanned poem by Ivanov. And I think he got better and better throughout his life. And it's the poems he, actually the poems that he wrote entirely conscious that he was dying in 1958, which I think are his very, very greatest poems. Spring exaltation, nightingales, the moon on southern seas. They make my poor head spin with boredom. More than that, I disappear. The real me lives elsewhere, far to the north. Berlin, poor Russian Paris, filthy Nice, a dream from which I soon will find release. Petersburg, winter. Gumilyov and I walk by an ice-bound Neva bright with snow. The river Lethe. Side by side, we walk and talk, as poets did so long ago. Another discovery for us, and a discovery for quite a lot of the Russians I've shown it to, is this poet Lev Ozerov, who is an honourable and moderately well-known poet, editor, translator, teacher of translators, a good man who helped a lot of important writers into print or back into print. He got Zabolotsky published for the first time after his return from the Gulag, for example, and wrote, you know, good but fairly conventional poetry throughout his life. I may be underestimating him, there may be more that I haven't yet read. But at the end of his life, he started working in the 1990s. He was working on these free verse poems that are quite unlike anything in Russian literature before them. And they have the appearance of just casual anecdote, as if he just met the guy in a pub and he starts telling you about his meeting with Pasternak or Akhmatova or some ballet dancer. You have to read them quite a few times and you keep realising that every detail is very carefully chosen and just how much they say about the person in question. So a lot of them, the book is called Portraits Without Frames. He was also a good violinist and a good artist. So all of them have little line drawings, which actually are extremely good. Yes, I mean, for instance, I've read his poem about Zabolotsky, about sort of 3 or 4 pages, and his 50-page essay about Zabolotsky. And the 50-page essay is a perfectly good essay. It's much more interesting than most literary criticism. But it's, you know, most of the important bits of it are in the short poem. So we've given him quite a lot of space in our anthology. He was one of the people we were kind of stuffing in at the very end. What can we get rid of to make more room for Ozerov? And we're very, very keen to publish this collection as a whole. We're working on it. And Irina's going to read her translation of a poem by Akhmatova.
So it's a free portrait of an Akhmatova. And I must confess that it took some convincing. I also had to reassess the poetic quality of Lev Ozerov's work. And before that, to me, he was just someone who was very, very, very decent, very honorable person, who was very instrumental in publishing Pasternak's famous collection in the mid-60s. Lev Ozerov, Anna Andreevna Akhmatova. A loose-fitting robe, or a house coat, or better yet, a coverall, disguises her corpulence, a gift of the prison queues. Those used to her slimness cannot believe she has grown so stout. It's Akhmatova, they say, but not Akhmatova. You may not have known that I stood day after day in those long queues outside prisons, feet swelling, heart giving up, said Anna Andreevna, passing me a photo of herself, straw thin, lying on her stomach and touching the nape of her neck, the fringe of her little white cap, with her toes. Painters never tired of depicting her grace, her proud angularity, her bangs, the hump of her nose, the tall neck, the elongation, the length, her height. Somewhere behind her, a lane of Tsarskoye Selo, by way of background, a balcony railing. The lilac coverall, its dark violet folds flow, overflow, and iridesce. Her face is pale, lit from within. I received this letter. Please read it aloud. It begins with praise, a bad sign. Better skip that. Start further down. That asked me for poems. I'd send some, my new ones, of course. And what does he answer? But can we not republish some of your old ones? A pause. What can I say? See how they treat me? I am silent. What can I say? Like some servant girl. Don't say that, I protest. Everyone knows you're an empress. Akhmatova grows quiet. She gets ready to listen. So I go on, as best as I can. Of course, you're an empress. She fixes her shawl, lowers her eyelids, lifts her head, and though she doesn't say, go on, I do go on, in the same spirit. Who will remember him, this foolish editor? But every line of yours, whether early or late, will be worth its weight in gold. No, that's not right. It will be beyond price. Without turning her head, Anna Andreevna looks towards the speaker, and he notices a fleeting light of pleasure on her face. Beatitude. Every single person, shepherd or prime minister, stoker or poet, wants to hear the word. They have been waiting to hear all their lives. As they grow older, people want to know that their life was not been lived in vain.
It's a wonderful combination in all his work of a kind of clarity of perception and a kind of generosity of spirit. So we're finishing with Varlam Shalamov, who in Russia is absolutely without question accepted as the great writer about the Gulag for his short stories about the labor camps of Kalama in the far northeast of the Soviet Union, where he spent about 17 years. He himself attached at least equal importance to his poetry. His poetry has been neglected. I think it's been underrated. I think that is beginning to change now. I think he's an extraordinary lyric poet. So one thing that he does is to, I mean, he knew Russian poetry really, really well. He knew the poetry of the Silver Age, the early 20th century, the symbolists, really well. They have all their sort of themes, their sort of semi-mystical themes of sort of, does the world really exist or is it just a dream, this kind of thing, which can be a bit self-indulgent. In poems like this, these sort of themes acquire a different kind of reality. This is a man who spent nearly 20 years in the, more or less in the Arctic, doubting whether or not sort of European culture really exists. Memory has veiled much evil. Her long lies leave nothing to believe. There may be no cities or green gardens, only fields of ice and salty oceans. The world may be pure snow, a starry road, just northern forest in the mind of God. And a wonderfully simple, very, very poem that works perfectly at a realistic level and has huge resonance. This theme again of thaw, how does one become unfrozen? By candlelight, in midday dark, I'll warm your words beside the stove. Frosts frozen them. Frost's wordless spell has made your letter dumb. The letters melt, drip tears, calling me home. And I shall finish with a rather mysterious poem. I'm not sure whether the address that is going to be mentioned is God or an audience. And so I keep going. Death remains close. I carry my life in a blue envelope. The letter's been ready ever since autumn. Just one little word, it couldn't be shorter. But I still don't know where I should send it. If I had the address, my life might have ended. So that's just a very, very small sample of the well over half our anthology is actually taken up with kind of the 20th century or the first sort of 60 or 70 years of the 20th century. I think the poets that it's left me most wanting to read more of are Ivanov, Ozurov, and also the poet that we'll be reading in a reading we're doing in a couple of days' time in Oxford, Boris Slutsky, but we've left him out tonight. But that gives me the opportunity to mention among the different books on sale. This is a very, very good book by Jerry Smith, whom Stephen mentioned a little while ago. It's a kind of model example of introduction to a Russian poet, a kind of mixture of translation, biography, commentary, all kind of very seamlessly welded together. And there's also this little book that Boris has translated together with Irina by Irina's late husband, Oleg Vulf. Very delicate, complex little stories. And books by Irina in Russian. And this Cardinal Points anthology, which is the brainchild of Irina and Oleg Vulf. Largely poetry, but many other things as well. An English language offshoot from sort of Russian language publishing they were doing in the east coast of the States. And Boris and I gradually sort of got recruited into this project, and so this is really kind of where the origin of us working together on the anthology. So thank you very much to the bookshop, and thank you all of readers and listeners. And we've kept extraordinarily well to our timing, so we have got plenty of time for discussion.
Really, just a comment and perhaps a short question. It's really fantastic to have such an exciting anthology of so much new material. So often anthologies come out and it's a sort of quirky view of a particular poet on the state of the art in the nation. But this is just absolutely wonderful. Now, you've concentrated on the 20th century, but I just wanted to sort of mention that there's also, you know, the pre-20, from Pushkin onwards it really is, it's terrific. And I particularly appreciate the new translation of Pushkin's The Bronze Horseman, which you have Stanley Mitchell, the late Stanley Mitchell, and Anthony Wood. I don't know whether you want to say anything about that.
Well, thank you for mentioning it. Certainly it's one of the glories of the anthology, I think, to have a great translation of what many people see as Pushkin's masterpiece, The Bronze Horseman. There's kind of two really great poems by Pushkin, the longer Evgeny Onyegin, which the late Stanley Mitchell translated brilliantly, really great, you know, one of the great first translations into English, and is published by Penguin Classics a few years ago. And it is, I mean, I am sad and ashamed that I was a bit slow and hesitant making up my mind, how much space, you know, questions of space and so on. I was a bit slow to commission Stanley to translate The Bronze Horseman for our anthology. And as it happened, he translated the prologue, which is about the first quarter of the poem, and then died aged 80 of a heart attack. After I had just asked him to translate the rest of the poem, but he'd only done a few more lines. And Anthony Wood just picked up where he left off. And Anthony Wood has been translating Pushkin for decades, many decades, and just getting better and better at it. And I think it's the greatest of Anthony's Pushkin translations. And he has now gone back. I mean, he has done his own version of the prologue, which he will be publishing. He's doing a Bronze Horseman and Other Narrative Poems by Pushkin for Penguin Classics, which will be coming out, I'm not quite sure, probably another couple of years or so. But no, I was very, very excited indeed to receive Anthony's draft of that. So thank you for mentioning it.
I want to add that when Evgeny Onyegin came out, we asked Stanley to write a short reflection on his work. And when translators work with the text, they actually live with this text for years. And in Stanley's case, it was 20 years, yeah, I believe, about 20 years.
Yeah, not equally all the time, but 20 years.
On and off. So he wrote, and we asked that this piece be not academic, and just whatever comes to mind. And he wrote a very, I would say, confessional, very intimate essay, which we published in our first, very first issue of Cardinal Points. And we're honored to have started Cardinal Points with such an
It is a deeply moving essay, and thank you for mentioning it.
And it's available online, so you can easily find it.
I wonder, in your opinion, how well do Russians look after their 20th century poetry now? I wonder whether they produce good quality publications or good editions, you know, looked after by qualified people who know what they are doing. So, in your opinion, please.
We may have several answers to that. I mean, my answer is that a lot of things in Russia, or perhaps most things, are done extraordinarily badly. And then you have these little tiny islands appear here and there of quite extraordinary excellence. And there are a number of Russian writers, Andrei Platonov, the prose writer, is benefiting from extraordinary conscientious, careful editing. You know, just wonderful editions with all his variants and deletions and so on. Absolute model, which is hard to conceive of happening in the Anglophone world. And this edition of Georgi Ivanov, which is quite recent. When was it published?
2005 and revised in 2009. It's a spectacular edition.
It's an excellent edition, really, really done with real scholarship and love.
It's published in a series, though, which is a continuation of the famous Soviet Bibliotheca Poeta.
Большая.
There's a Mahler as well, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to add anything, Irina?
No, I agree that it's very hard to generalize, as always.
Yes. Well, you know, the Soviet editions were spectacular, except for all the missing parts. at least now we have all the parts. One thing I would like to say is that the internet is a remarkable resource for those old Soviet editions. There's a great website called FEB, FebWeb, which gives you a wonderful, wonderful online resource of all of the great scholarly editions. Not all of the great scholarly editions, but many of the ones that you would want to find. So the work is more accessible than it's been in a long time.
Can I just say, I'm not sure what the publishing conditions for poetry are in contemporary Russia now, but I remember when I was a student in Moscow in the early 80s, the thing that struck me was how extraordinarily popular poetry was among ordinary readers. I mean, you'd be traveling on the tube and you'd see people kind of reading, you know, immersed in volumes of poetry, which always used to be carefully covered in paper. They used to take immense care over these things.
Yeah.
I remember one weekend, a friend of mine who knew that I was doing research on Marina Tsvetaeva, she said, she mentioned that there was a poetry reading of Tsvetaeva at the university on Saturday evening at 8 o'clock. And she asked me if I'd be interested in going, so I said, sure. And I remember thinking, we'd be bound to get tickets, because, I mean, a poetry reading at 8 o'clock on a Saturday night, it's not going to be a huge draw. She came back a couple of days later and said, I'm sorry, I couldn't get tickets, it's sold out. So that's the kind of level of interest there used to be in poetry in the Soviet period.
In certain poets, I'd say. I mean, the 13-volume collected works of Mayakovsky that was published in the 1950s came out in an edition of 100,000 copies and was publicly promoted and so on. And they're currently doing a 20-volume collected works, which, as Boris says, will contain all the bits that they didn't put in the Bad Rise version, and that's an edition of 600 copies. Yeah. So, you know, there's publishing pressures as well.
The great favourite, though, in Soviet times, in my experience, was Yesenin. He was the one that the ordinary readers used to particularly love. I always remember, if you went to visit a Soviet family, even if it wasn't a particularly literary, intellectual family, you could always be sure to find at least two volumes of poetry on the bookshelves. One would be Pushkin, and the other one would be Yesenin. He had he occupied a strange kind of position in Russian culture. As Robert mentioned earlier, he was always kind of looked down upon by academics and critics. They kind of tended to sneer at him. But ordinary Russian readers, he was the one that they warmed to, that they really loved.
Didn't Harold Macmillan once say that throughout the British Empire, you go into a house and there were three books, the Bible, Shakespeare, and a collection of Kipling?
Yeah,
sounds like a similar kind of thing.
He occupied that kind of similar position. Or I sometimes think, I mean, the comparison is a weird one in a way. He was a bit like John Betjeman.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yeah.
I mean,
on
the surface, I mean, you couldn't imagine two characters, two writers more different.
Mutatis mutandis. Yeah.
But in terms of the position that they occupied in the culture. There was a similarity, I think.
Mm-hmm. I would say not necessarily with Pushkin. I would say Yesenin certainly was a must, and next to him, Omar Khayyam.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow it worked well together.
Yeah. Robert Burns as well.
In Marshak's translation.
Yes.
which I thought was a testimony to the power of translation.
Yes.
The reputation that Robert Burns had, in particular in the Soviet Union. Translated by the work of a very well-known translator, who a lot of people criticise, I think, because he took liberties, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yes, but
good liberties.
they worked. I mean, people read his translations, and you know, they meant something to people.
Absolutely.
More questions.
Thank you very much. This is great. For those of us who don't speak Russian, can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges of translating from Russian into English when you're dealing particularly with poetry and some of the formal conventions of Russian and how that can be tricky when you're translating into English?
I always get completely paralyzed by this kind of very general questions about how does one translate something. I can sort of talk happily for ages about with some sort of trying to find the right version of a single line of a poem, but what to say when answer to a... I mean, one can only say things, I suppose, that are sort of dully general, which is you can see from the... If you look through the anthology that we have favoured translations that use metre and rhyme, although in some cases it may be more a matter of hinting at metre and rhyme. It's obviously naive to think that, say, four-foot iambics with alternating masculine and feminine rhymes are going to have exactly the same effect in English as they would have in Russian. So to kind of insist on precisely reproducing the exact form is completely bonkers. I mean, it just is infinitely easier to far more Russian words rhyme than do English words. You know, they have rather a small number of vowel sounds in Russian, for a start. They don't have our huge range of diphthongs. So to insist on full rhyme rather than kind of following people like Yeats and Wilfred Owen in using half rhyme would be crazy. I think there are quite a variety of approaches. I mean, I think probably Stephen probably has observed metre and rhyme pretty strictly in all your translations in this anthology.
In the Ivanov translations, in particular, because I take the view that in his poetry, in particular, rhyme and metre does play a very prominent role.
I mean, there are some. I mean, I have two, but there have been some poems. Surprisingly, actually, a few poems of Akhmatova's where the line of thought seemed so precise that I couldn't reproduce it without some deviation if I was going to use rhyme, and it felt more important to actually keep to that sort of rather bare, simple thought. It makes better sense if I actually read the poem I'm thinking of. It'll take me a moment to find, but Akhmatova can sometimes write very, very simply, and I kind of just reproducing that simplicity and tone seemed more important than anything. So this is a First World War poem. She gives this a location, even 1915, St. Petersburg, Trinity Bridge. We had thought we were beggars with nothing at all. But as loss followed loss and each day became a day of memorial, we began to make songs about the Lord's generosity and our bygone wealth. Just any sort of any extra ornament or anything, anything that would have interfered with that. It's got such a clear movement, it seemed... I couldn't make it work in any other way, and I feel it does work that way. But if you'd asked me if I'd, in abstract, I'd prefer to translate Akhmatova into metre and rhyme.
I think you have to make a judgment on each individual poem. I mean, some poems you can translate without using rhyme and metre. Others, as I said before, rhyme and metre just seems to be absolutely essential. It's part of the structure. And Ivanov is a case in point. I mean, there are some Ivanov poems which, if you translate them into prose, you're just left with a series of non sequiturs, a series of kind of statements that don't seem to have any particular logical connection to each other. And the thing that kind of holds them all together in an Ivanov poem in Russian is the rhyme and the meter. So it varies from poem to poem. I think there are no, you know, there are no general rules. You just have to kind of decide as you go along.
Yeah, in some poems, music is the logic.
And that's precisely what
happens in Ivanov.
Yeah.
There is this pit in every poem, this little pit, you know, the core. So you have to find this pit. And the way you find it doesn't really matter, the very way you find this pit. It could be through the meter, different meter, when you travel into a different realm of a different language where meters are heard differently, or this kind of rhyming, again, against the background of the rhyming tradition of this country, right? There are so many things, but I absolutely agree with Stephen that each poem is a creature, and you do not approach, like you do not approach human beings with the same right attitude. It's the same thing. Same is true for poems.
Well, Pound has said that poetry is language charged to the highest possible degree, to the utmost possible degree. I think translation is reading charged to the utmost possible degree. It's an act of profound understanding, or attempting to understand, and to sympathize with the speaker, and to identify to some degree. And once you've managed to do that, even if objectively you're mistaken about the meaning of the poem, once you've managed to somehow get a sense, a full sense of who stands behind this piece, then you can begin to fashion a poem in another language.
Valia.
I may use this opportunity to mention that for those of you who are interested in translation, next month, one of the best Russian translators of English poetry, Grigory Krushkov, will be giving a talk on the topic Mystery of Translation, or One for All in the Waterstone, Piccadilly. So please do come on the 27th of April next month. And the second little point, previous question about the state of contemporary modern Russian poetry now, it would be suitable to mention that apart from publishing houses, there are plenty, still dozens and dozens of so-called thick journals, Tolstoy journals, like Znamya, Zvezda, Novy Mir, and almost in every big city there is such thick journal where you can find section of poetry. So modern poetry is still sort of active and published well.
Obviously, Mayakovsky was a committed revolutionary, or at least committed to the revolution for his whole life. But it seems like there's often a kind of desire to separate his poetry from his politics, including recent biography, Jungfeld biography. I just wonder, really, like, how do you feel his politics affected his poetry and his popularity? Because it sounds like obviously there's a huge gap between the, you know, fall, the before and after the fall of the Soviet Union. Do you feel, you know, when you approached it, do you have a particular attitude to his politics, or you know?
I think I have an advantage as any translator of Mayakovsky does, who doesn't sit down to translate 20 volumes of collected poetry and prose, in that you can choose the good bits and leave the bad bits out. How you decide what the good bits are and what the bad bits are is another question. Mayakovsky is a very interesting example, though, of a poet, as you say, in whom it's impossible to separate the politics and the poetry, and in whose life in general it's impossible to separate the politics and the poetry. I mean, you just need to think about the sort of hub of ideas relative to his suicide. Was he thinking that, I mean, there's lots of speculation, of course. Was he upset with what was happening with Russia, or was he upset because he'd been unlucky in love again for the 50th time in his life or whatever? I think that the essential, I mean, this is going to sound wanky, but the essential truth of Mayakovsky is that these things are inseparable. So a poem like Praeta, for example, a long narrative poem, is equally about politics as it is about his love, even though it starts, I mean, it says Praeta, it's called about this, and the this that it refers to is specifically love. I mean, directly spoken, always been love. But equally, it's a political poem about how in some not really fantastical socialist future, there is the possibility of love not simply being some sort of individual relationship between a man and a woman, but love being something wider and more general inside an entire society. And that's something you do have to reflect. I think, I mean, you said that Jungfeld's biography kind of played down the politics, but I think one of the things that it does do is make it clear the extent to which Mayakovsky wasn't simply a political spokesman for the changing ideology of the Soviet government of the time. I mean, I think that it shows very clearly the moments at which he stood apart from that, but still in a political sense, obviously. So that
you go by the breath. You hear the breath in the poem. It's it is inseparable. No matter how the poet writes, there is a smell of steel in some long lines, just a smell, you just physically feel it. And some are really free and, like I would say, carefree in a way. And some are, you feel the suffocation of the kind one feels when one reads Bloch's latest poems. It's just the physical sense of suffocation. And I think that may also be one of the answers to your question. Just, we're very grateful to you that you came here tonight.
Yeah. It's wonderful to see so many people come out to listen to Russian poetry.
Especially in translation. It's not very easy to listen to poetry in translation. We're very grateful.
Anyway, thank you very much, Robert, Boris, Irina, James, and Stephen.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.